Hello, and welcome to the Business Decisions Podcast. My name is Stuart Wood, and I'm the CEO of Caravel Law. Every week, we bring you stories and insights from founders, owners, and leaders of great businesses, followed by some thoughts and input from one of Caravel's lawyers. Caravel Law has been a leader in legal innovation in Canada since 2004 and has helped many startups and small businesses overcome challenges as they have scaled and succeeded. Our hope is that these discussions will help existing business leaders and inspire others to start their own ventures. Now, let's get to today's guest. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Glenn Brown of Highbury Jewelry. Glenn and I will discuss the custom jewelry industry and how he has built Highbury Jewelry, some of the differences between his business and a retail store. We'll also discuss some of the key agreements that he has in place and some of the challenges that accompany building a business where each product is specific to an individual client. Following my discussion with Glenn Brown, I'll be joined by Phil Kennedy of Caravel Law. We'll discuss some of the risks associated with building your business using oral agreements as opposed to written contracts, and some of the ways that businesses can put written contracts in place that are more user-friendly and less intimidating to your customers. So with that, let's get to my conversation with Glenn Brown of Highbury Jewelry. All right, I'm delighted to be joined on the podcast today by Glenn Brown. Glenn is the owner and chief designer at Highbury Jewelry. He has 31 years in the jewelry industry and studied at the Gemological Institute of America, also known as the GIA. He has wholesale, retail, and manufacturing experience, and I'm delighted to have him on the podcast today. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you for having me, Stuart.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about Highbury Jewelry?
Sure. So Highbury Jewelry is a bit of a culmination from my experience in the industry. And having experience in seeing what a lot of retail jewelry and manufacturing processes were about, where I felt that what the true essence of jewelry was being lost. And so what I wanted to do was create a brand which had a standard attached to it. And the three pillars of what Highbury stands for is design, quality, and craftsmanship. And what that means is that the design is going to be properly representing what a fine piece of jewelry should look like. Quality is self-explanatory in that it's going to be not just the gemstones that we're dealing with, but the quality of the workmanship and the materials that are involved. And then craftsmanship, again, self-explanatory, where it's about finding the right people to do the job and overseeing the work to make sure that at each stage of the process that it's done to the standard, which is going to represent what Highbury is.
And you custom design each piece?
Yes, I do.
So it seems like even though it's the same industry, it's a very different business from jewelry stores that we would see.
It is. And one of the biggest reasons is that jewelry stores have a very high cost to operate. So there is staffing, there is high rent, there is high costs on security, not only alarm systems, but showcases and safes. So all of these things are factors into what a jewelry store needs to charge. When you do customing, it's like bespoke. So I don't have a huge outlay of expenses that I need to recoup when I do a job. And what I'm able to do is work with my clients, come to a point where we find out what their desires are. I don't like to use the word needs in jewelry because needs are not what jewelry is about, but find what their desires are and then go from there and tailor make and fine tune something to create that fine piece of jewelry for them. It lets me do a quality piece of work, which doesn't have the same price tag of what a retail store would have.
So you've been running Highbury for 27 years now. For that long of a track record of success, you must have made a lot of pieces for a lot of clients. Where do you usually find your clients?
At the early days, it becomes a lot of hard work where you have to meet a lot of people, get your work in front of a lot of people, and explain what your business concept is about. And as time goes by, thankfully, I have had work that people appreciate. So the referral business has grown substantially. And now, as we are into such an age of the internet and social media, having a presence in those areas is the continuation of that.
And is each piece made for a specific client, or do you do some pieces that then you look to sell?
The majority of pieces are done for clients as they have ideas that they bring to me. But there are a degree of pieces that I do where I will take inspirations from ideas that just sit in my head. I mean, around my house, you'll find little napkins or bits of paper with all kinds of scribbles on them that are the beginnings of something that I have in mind. Or it might be somewhere I am, if I'm at a gem dealer, I see a stone that really catches me, and I'll buy the stone, and then I'll just start playing with designs around that. Those are usually one-off pieces, though.
Have you ever had trouble with people copying your designs? I noticed that you share a number of examples of your work on your website.
I do, and you know what? I'm not really worried about it. If they say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, so if somebody wants to copy work I do, they're welcome to do it. What I know that I do is that, again, it's not just the design, which is what my company is based upon. It's also the quality and the craftsmanship. And I know that most people have a hesitation to spend what I spend on that aspect of my piece of jewelry. And so I know that there's always something that probably differentiates me from even somebody who's copied a piece of mine.
And do you have trouble with people coming in, working with you on a design, but then sourcing the piece themselves elsewhere?
Not very often, to be honest. And the reason I think it is because I'm very comprehensive in my meetings with my clients. This is what I can bring to the table because I have a lot of years experience in the industry, but not just in retail jewelry, but in wholesale, in manufacturing. And I've been exposed to a lot of very, very talented people over the time I've been in it. So I've learned a lot from them as well. And I like to convey that to my clients. So I think when they have a discussion with me, and then they have a discussion with a lot of other people, especially if you were in a retail jewelry store, in a mall, let's say in particular, that there's a really different level of competency that they see after a discussion with me.
I guess the nice part of having each piece be unique is that people can't do the research and then just go buy it online from another retailer.
They can't. And I mean, it's not to say that there isn't people that come to see me that have a very simple design, but they still appreciate the fact that they're getting an education about the gemstone that they're buying from me, and that they know that there is a very personal supervision on that piece, and that it's not... Think of it like a suit. You can buy a suit off the rack, or you can have somebody measure you up and create that suit for you. Might look the same, but it definitely feels different.
So Glenn, if someone comes to you with an idea, what's the amount of time between a design idea and a finished piece?
So the design time depends on the client. So let's assume that's finished. We have agreed upon design, a stone selected. Generally, my tradespeople, depending on the complication of the piece, take 2 to 3 weeks. And then the one thing I do is I have every piece of jewelry that I create appraised by an independent appraisal lab. And that's kind of my assurance of quality. So it's, I'm not telling you what I said it is. It's somebody else who's independent of me who is verifying that it is what I said it is. And that's usually an extra week. So in general, 2 to 3 weeks, complicated piece, maybe 4.
So you mentioned inspiration comes from a lot of different places, and you have these scraps around your house with ideas and designs. Do you start from a gemstone? Do you start from a sense of knowing the client and the kinds of thing that they're looking for? How does the inspiration come to you?
Comes from all of the above, really. So as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of times I'll see a gemstone that just really catches my eye, and I don't know what I want to do with it, but I have maybe a brief idea. So I'll just buy the gemstone based on that. And those might sit around for 2-3 years before I ever come up with the right idea for it, but it's still an inspiration for an idea. People bring in their own ideas, which then I will help to fine tune with them so that we can create a nice piece. But also, I'm a very form-driven designer. So when I travel, a lot of my photography is of very focused and trimmed images that give me the idea for a design form. So it's not the kind of picture you'd share with your friends of look at my holiday, but I know what I saw there, and it lets me have ideas of what I want to do in terms of a piece of jewelry.
So in terms of the stones that you start with occasionally, how do you know what stones are in style or which stones are even available in the market?
Well, in the entire fashion industry, there's always kind of the Pantone flavor of the year. So certain colors are very trendy, and sometimes that translates into the gem world, but sometimes it's really more stuck into the textile fashion world.
Well, we're recording this in the fall of 2019. Are there any stones that are particularly in fashion right now?
Well, in Canada in particular, diamonds never have an off season. If you wanted to pull a fall color, I mean, stones like citrines and topazes are very nice because they bring out those rich autumn colors. This year, a lot of purples and even more lavender colors have been very trendy. But you also end up having the traditionals because gemstones have a history that dates back thousands of years. So there are always those staples, which are the blue sapphire, the ruby, the emerald that people always take to. And what I like to do is take some of those thoughts and introduce people to a piece I did not long ago where somebody was very set on an emerald and introduced them to a Zavorite garnet. And a lot of times, because that's not what the typical retail offering is, people have never heard about it. And so it's taking what people are accustomed to, but introducing them to new versions of that color tone.
Do you have a favorite stone or one that you think is particularly underappreciated?
I do. And it's just a particular preference of my own, which is the blue tourmaline. And it is simply because it just has a color that I have a real attraction to. And there's nothing else beyond that. There's not any mystical background or zodiac connection that makes it that way. Even when I did my wife's engagement ring, I asked her, I said, listen, I really like colored stones. We're going to do color. And I said, what's your favorite color? And she said, blue. And I said, light blue or dark blue? And then I chose stones based on that.
And do you see people bringing more creativity into the engagement ring design than they used to?
I would say that people are now focused a little too much on the technicality of gemstones, and they're forgetting about the design of a ring. So what the internet has done is it's brought, you know, I went to school, but apparently now people can learn everything I did over the course of a few years and, you know, 3 hours online on a Thursday night. So I have people bringing me like their laundry list of what kind of stone quality they want. And the rings have almost become secondary to some people. There are people that still come to me and give me carte blanche. And they'll say, you know, this is what I want to do, a pendant, and I want a stone like this. And I'll create anywhere between 5 to 10 real preliminary designs and then fine-tune it from there. But it's the internet has changed the way people have approached jewelry, I think, in a lot of ways.
So in terms of the partnerships that you have in place, what are keys to being able to successfully execute all these designs that you come up with?
The execution of the designs really is part of the supply base. So where I can get my gems and the craftsmen that I have that do the actual labor. Diamonds can be just put into the actual wax and then cast from there. And, you know, you get all your small stones are crooked. What I do is I have a goldsmith create a piece. Then I have a setter who does the actual setting. I have a finisher who does his work. And in the jewelry industry, it's not about you fill out a credit application and then you have credit with somebody. You build relationships. Like, I remember when I first moved to Toronto that I deal with one of the largest diamond dealers in Canada. And my credit application was basically a 30-minute sit-down interview, and that's the credit that I have. So the relationships you build when you are able to speak to somebody and say, this is what I'm looking for in a stone, and they understand what you're talking about, and they know what to bring out, because to spend time and look through 200 stones at 5 different dealers is kind of a waste. So it's the relationships, the understanding, and people that appreciate what you're looking for out of the kind of work you do. And that's where my tradespeople in particular know that if the job isn't this way, they know I'm going to make them redo it. So everybody understands each other.
So if the credit application was done informally like that, what kind of agreements do you have in place with your key suppliers?
Well, they want me to pay. That's the key one. But it's a very broad spectrum of people that are in this industry. So my suppliers will always have what everybody needs, but it's knowing what I need. So they understand what my desires are. And because I'm generally dealing in a higher quality, my goods are a higher price. And it's them being comfortable. And again, it comes down to everybody paying. I mean, one thing about jewelry is it's the most transportable bit of wealth that exists in the world. So anybody who would be dishonest, it's pretty easy to throw a few diamonds in your pocket and walk away. It's completely untraceable. So it's the trust factor becomes the biggest factor.
And with diamonds specifically, there's now an increased focus on where the diamonds come from. Are you finding that more people are asking you about that?
Yep.
And how do you manage that within the industry?
Well, transparency is the biggest part of it. So marketing always has its influence on anything. And everybody knows that diamonds were always dug out of the ground. But the physics of it is that diamonds are created under high heat and high pressure. So they have now been able to replicate these conditions in laboratories. Now, some of the things that are misconceptions are that these are like environmentally better. But what people don't understand is that the energy that's required to produce these conditions leave a massive carbon footprint. So although you can save some money and think they're not digging a hole in the ground, it's still not the green way to purchase a diamond. The trick is that they are technically diamonds. They are physically and chemically a diamond. So they are very difficult to tell apart. And this is where transparency is key, is that you hope that somebody isn't going to be selling you a lab-grown diamond as a naturally mined diamond. And the consumer will never tell. And unfortunately, I have to tell you that there's a lot of retailers that can't tell either. So they're susceptible to being duped. And I think that I do continuous studies, and I have taken a number of courses on being able to identify synthetic from natural diamonds. And it's about being upfront and telling people what the differences are. And because I do custom jewelry, I'm not under pressure to sell one or the other. If somebody really wants a synthetic diamond, we can have that discussion. But I generally prefer to deal with the diamonds from nature.
And there are diamonds in Canada.
Actually, Canada is one of the globe's largest producers of diamonds. We have the fortunacy of producing high-quality diamonds. So a diamond mine is generally judged by the value per carat of what comes out of the mine. And although a country like Australia produces way more volume than Canada does, we're only second to Russia in the world in terms of the value of the diamonds that come out of Canada. So we have that going for us, but we also were the first country and are still the only country that has tracked our diamonds. So if somebody has concerns about blood diamonds or origin of diamonds at all, the beauty of Canadian diamonds is that in cooperation with the government and the jewelry industry, our diamonds are all tracked and they're serial numbered, and through a very highly technical process identified so that you know that these are Canadian diamonds, and they've become a brand globally.
Do you have people who specifically request diamonds from Canada?
I do, all the time, actually.
Is it just in Northwest Territories, or is there other places in Canada where they're sold, or they're mined?
It's the Northwest Territory is the largest producer. There are some diamonds in Nunavut. There's been discoveries in Ontario and Quebec. Those haven't become really large producing mines. It's primarily Northwest Territories.
In terms of Highbury Jewelry, what are your plans for the business going forward?
Well, as I mentioned, the internet has changed the industry a lot. And although I do have a website, I am in the process of having that redesigned. I realize the effect social media has on consumers as well. So there's going to be a tie-in to Instagram on there. And probably look at doing some limited edition pieces that we will start to offer through Instagram. Something a little more price-wise consumer-friendly, but still maintaining the quality that is demanded by the Highbury brand.
Do clients usually like it when you put their piece out as an example of your work?
I find most people are flattered by it because, in truth, I don't put everybody's out. I just try to put a little example of some pieces there that I think are a bit different. So I think most people are flattered by it.
Well, that's great. So if people are interested in learning more about Highbury Jewelry or working with you on a custom piece, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Best way would be to go to my website at Highbury Jewelry, which is HIGHBURYJEWELLERY.com. And there's a gallery of some of my previous work, a little bit of a breakdown of what custom jewelry is all about. Also, a section where you can look up some stones. And we're working on an aspect where people will be able to upload some design ideas they might have and get a conversation started on that right from the website.
That sounds fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Glenn. I really enjoyed learning more about Highbury Jewelry.
Thank you for taking the time to have me.
Really enjoyed that conversation with Glenn about Highbury Jewelry. Now I'm going to bring on Phil Kennedy from Caravel Law to talk about a couple of the issues that came up during our conversation. I'm delighted now to be joined on the podcast by Phil Kennedy from Caravel Law. Phil, why don't you tell us a little bit about your practice?
Yes, thanks, Stuart. I've been a lawyer for about 18 years now, I suppose. And first and foremost, I'm a corporate and commercial litigator. My approach to resolving disputes for clients is fairly holistic. So I advise on ways to minimize the risk of business conflict. I advise clients on alternative dispute resolution processes and rules that people may want to incorporate into their standard contracts. A lot of people come to me and they want to know about their contractual rights and obligations. I assist with pre-litigation dispute negotiation and resolution, and obviously the commencement and prosecution of court proceedings in various courts. That's sort of an overview of the litigation practice. Also draft share purchase and asset purchase agreements if people are buying or selling businesses. I try to bring the perspective of a litigator to a lot of these processes. I look at agreements and decide, are they clear? Are they ambiguous? Is there something there that could be exploited by the other side if a dispute was to arise?
Well, we just heard about a business, Highbury Jewelry, where there are a lot of agreements without formal written contracts in place. So just in a general sense, what are some of the risks to a business without those formal written contracts in place?
I think what you're describing is perhaps not uncommon. There's a lot of business people that rely on handshakes or oral deals instead of having a written contract that sets out the party's rights and obligations. That often comes from a flush of enthusiasm about the strength of the relationship at the beginning, and there's often a lot of goodwill at the beginning that may break down over time. A lot of entrepreneurs, small business people tend to overestimate the strength of their memory about the terms that were agreed. You may think that you've shared the same terms and conditions with this particular client that you typically share, and you may have missed some things, and the client or the customer may have a different perspective on what the agreement is. When a dispute arises, then you'll have to spend a lot of time on just establishing what the terms of the agreement or the transaction are. And that's not always easy when the agreement has been formed over a number of conversations. And often the other side, to whom the transaction may be a little bit more unique than you, where you're dealing with the same kind of transaction over and over again, your memory might be more clouded, in which case their credibility might stand up better than yours if there's a dispute about what was agreed. One of the other things is, as a business person, you may be very familiar with the custom of the trade, and you may think that everybody understands the custom of the trade. But if you have to go to court and prove what that custom is, you might have to bring in an independent expert to just establish what normally happens. Not having a written contract, of course, may actually encourage disputes in the sense that parties may feel more at liberty to interpret the terms of what was agreed than they would be able to if it's reduced to black and white writing. And of course, if you don't have a written contract, you have to fall back on the common law. So there's no necessary limitation on your liability or on potential damages. Without those things, you just have a lot more ambiguity, a lot more potential for dispute.
So if someone is running their business without written contracts in place, often it might be because they're looking for something more straightforward and user-friendly. Are there alternatives to standard contracts that would accomplish that for a business?
Well, it depends what you mean by standard contract, Stuart. I think people typically think of a dense, closely written document full of legalese and jargon that the layperson has a lot of trouble understanding. For decades now, there has been a movement to provide businesses with more user-friendly, business-friendly contracts that really anyone can sit down and understand their obligations and their rights. You know, some people don't want to have a standard contract because it's just a costly exercise. And I suggest that's a bad reason, because it only takes the extra cost of one significant dispute or lawsuit based on a dispute over oral terms of an agreement, justify the cost of preparing written standard terms. But the other reason that some people may avoid having legal documents is really that they consider them off-putting to customers, and it's not the image they want to project for their business. Their business is built on a handshake. They prefer a friendly kind of relationship without what seems to be the adversarial nature of having people sign a written contract. And that may work for a very small business that deals with many customers where each transaction is of relatively low value. But as businesses grow, the importance of particular relationships increase, then it's more and more important to have a written document. Look, I was involved in a process undertaken by a major bank to convert all of their complex agreements with their retail customers into plain language that their customers could actually understand. And so if a bank can do that, it's likely that your business also can have plain language, business-friendly documents and contracts that people won't mind signing. There's a number of aspects that go into plain language drafting that I think, at the end of the day, produce a document that really enhances a business rather than detracts from the business itself. What we would typically do as lawyers is sit down and try and understand your business, nature of your business relationships, the nature of the transactions you engage in, and then use user-friendly layperson's language to create and prepare contract documents that really serve to enhance certainty and, as I say, that your clients won't object to signing. There's really no reason why you need a contract that is long, poorly structured, full of unnecessary and incomprehensible language. Sometimes you see contracts with pages of definitions, words like heretofore, indemnification, warrant, force majeure, and phrases like notwithstanding anything to the contrary herein. All of those phrases can be eliminated from a plain language document that just clearly sets out what your expectations are of the transaction and what your client, your customer can expect, and their rights and their obligations, as well as your own.
Well, that's a lot of really helpful information for people, Phil. Thank you very much for your time today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
I want to thank my guests on the podcast today, Glenn Brown of Highbury Jewelry and Phil Kennedy of Caravel Law. If you'd like more information about this podcast or about Caravel Law, check us out at caravellaw.com. You'll find a knowledge page there on the website where you can find older episodes of the podcast, as well as some additional information and helpful bulletins that we've sent out to our clients. Thank you for downloading and listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope you'll subscribe, leave us a rating, and potentially share this podcast with others that you feel might benefit from these conversations. We'll be back next week with episode 7 of the podcast. And until then, we hope all of your business decisions are great ones.